This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This past week, 1 year since the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, protests in that city turned violent and officials declared a state of emergency. We're going to talk a little bit about this roiling unrest, what's happening in these areas where people are demanding justice. You've had these high-profile racial incidents. Is anything good coming from it? Can we look at the fruits of it after a year and draw any conclusions? Next, the number of young adults in America age 18 to 34 is growing, but the number who are living on their own is shrinking. Census Bureau data shows that about 1 in 3 American adults in this age bracket are living with their parents or another relative. We're going to talk about what this says about America's economy, but more importantly, what this failure to launch says about family, and how much the responsibilities of family can help us to grow up. Trumpet writer Robert Morley and I are going to discuss some of the wonderful joys and benefits of family that await those who step out and go after them. Everybody knows the story of David and Goliath, a plucky Israelite teenager who defeated a mighty Philistine warrior. The Bible describes the Philistines as a very impressive people anciently. Well, a new archaeological finding backs up that historical record. We're going to talk to a man who's done quite a bit of archaeological work within Israel to tell us about it, where you can read about it directly in the pages of the Bible, the evidence that supports it, and what this archaeological find tells us about this ancient history. We're also going to answer some questions from our listeners, and I'll conclude the program today with a word from one of history's wisest men on how you should handle haters. All this on today's Trumpet Hour.
We're ready for war! We're ready for war! We're ready for war!
We're ready for what?
We're ready for war!
We're ready for what?
We're ready for war!
These were protesters in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri earlier this week. It's been 1 year since Michael Brown, a black teenager, was killed by a white police officer in this city. And people decided to commemorate the anniversary of that death by protesting. The protests began peacefully, but then gunfire started. Things turned violent, and Monday night, officials declared a state of emergency in that city to try to bring the situation under control. Now, according to police, they pulled up behind one young man who was shooting a gun, and he turned and started firing at them. They returned fire and hit him. Now he's in the hospital. Now, of course, there are protesters who are skeptical of the police's version of what happened. And there's this growing sense that the police just can't be trusted, that they're looking for excuses to prosecute minorities. This story is not going away. If you're not used to hearing about these stories yet, then buckle up, because this is the new normal in America. This is a movement that is gaining momentum. There are people who are deliberately stirring up these protests. I'm sure there are some who want them to be peaceful protests, but there are also definitely some who want them to be violent. There are a lot of people who are saying, we're ready for war. It's time for a race war. Now, at the Trumpet, we've been talking a lot about this in recent months, and really the last couple of years as this story has been building. The reason we're talking about it is because it is far more dangerous than people realize. In these areas where there have been these high-profile racial incidents and there have been people who are demanding justice, the problems are getting worse. What we're seeing in these areas is the police are pulling back and the problems are increasing. In Baltimore, where there was a large incident this past April, if you compare this May to last May, arrests were down 50% in that city, and violent crime went up by 15%, and murders went up by 76%. That's what happens when you start going after the police and really treating the police like criminals, which is happening in more and more of these cases. I want to go back and look at the cover story of the July issue of The Trumpet by Gerald Fleury. He was talking about what happened in Baltimore at that time. The title of the article is Your Cities Are Burned with Fire. You can read it on thetrumpet.com if you go there online and find that article in the July issue of The Trumpet. He was talking about how the police officers who were involved in the incident with Freddie Gray in that city, they were charged with murder and manslaughter and very severe charges that basically were made to try to calm people down. The crowd was baying for blood, and the Baltimore state attorney basically gave them the indictments that they were looking for. This article says it appears that decision was made out of fear of the rioters. If it wasn't a racially motivated effort to, quote unquote, seek justice at the expense of the law, state and federal authorities tried to show themselves sympathetic to the criminals even more than to the innocent people of Baltimore. Speaking of the people who were basically victimized by these violent mobs that destroyed the city. Whatever their reasons for doing so, the article continues, the big lesson this sent to protesters and agitators across the country was clear. Lawlessness gets results. Violent protests are a legitimate, effective means of seeking justice. What a dangerous example and precedent. And this is what we see contributing to other places around the country. Every time you have a high-profile case like this, then you have more anger. It bubbles to the surface more rapidly, and people seem to be really getting this notion that the only way to solve this problem is through violence. And in Baltimore, you had the police told to stand down. You had the officials making an example of these six policemen. This is the type of thing that absolutely guts the will of law enforcers. And that's not to excuse police brutality by any means, but we're talking about good policemen who are trying to do their jobs, who really have to be careful of the way that they conduct themselves for being accused of racist behavior when that isn't the case at all. This article by Gerald Fleury says, the institution that protects and preserves the stability of America's cities is being undermined and weakened. As the violence spreads, the will to stop it shrinks. The Baltimore incident will inevitably create more violence throughout America. Now, this past week, an amazing story came out about Freddie Gray, the man who died of that spinal cord injury while he was in police custody in Baltimore. This is August 8th from the Baltimore Sun. The police detectives who investigated the death of Freddie Gray were told that he had a history of participating in crash for cash schemes, injuring himself in law enforcement settings to collect settlements. But they were advised by a state prosecutor not to pursue the information, according to defense attorneys for the six officers charged in Gray's arrest and death. Assistant State's Attorney Janice Bledsoe told police investigators working the case in its early stages not to do the defense attorney's job for them by pursuing information they had about such schemes and evidence that Gray intentionally injured himself at the Baltimore City Detention Center. So essentially you have, again, these high-placed officials taking the side of the criminal rather than of the police. And meanwhile, the officer who was driving the van, he's charged with second-degree depraved heart murder. Two other officers are charged with manslaughter. Two others face lesser charges. They've all pleaded not guilty. Their trial starts in October. What do you suppose is going to happen if these officers are actually acquitted? I mean, we're talking about a man who deliberately, deceitfully would participate in a scheme to get money by making law enforcement officers look bad and trying to get hurt in situations so that he could collect money at the expense of law enforcement. That's his history. And that's evidence that has everything to do with what happened in this incident. And yet the assistant state attorney says this isn't relevant information. What happens if these guys are actually acquitted? It's obviously something that's going to come out in the trial, but you can be sure that people are going to take an acquittal as proof that the entire system is racist. Any facts that suggest otherwise simply cannot be true, so they would say. In so many of these individual cases, when you look at them, you look at the facts and you look at them rationally, you have to acknowledge that there is a lot of deceit going on in a deliberate attempt to stir up emotion and anger and to incite violence. There are people who are using these cases as symbols for their cause, and they're stirring up a lot of anger, and it doesn't matter what the facts are. It doesn't matter what the truth is. You're not going to hear about that Freddie Gray story. That evidence isn't going to quiet people down. It's not going to sway anybody who already knows in their own mind what happened there. In Ferguson, when these protests were going on this last weekend, you're still hearing this hands up, don't shoot story, even though that has been proven to be a complete lie. There are people who want war, and one way or another, they're going to get it. I want to just close with one more quote from this city, this article about burning cities. Gerald Flory wrote, "Now look at this lightning bolt prophecy, explaining the terrible consequences of our grave national sins." It says in Isaiah 1 and verse 7, "Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land, strangers devoured in your presence, and it is desolate as overthrown by strangers." He writes, "This prophecy is a guarantee that our national problems are going to get worse if we don't listen to God." He is pleading with us to hear his message, to listen to him, and to fear him, but we refuse. As a result, the degeneration continues to get much worse very rapidly. This is a story we're going to be hearing more about. It's a story we have to continue to watch because it's going to get worse. The violence is going to increase. The consequences are going to get much more severe. I would encourage you to read more about it in Gerald Flory's July cover story, "Your Cities Are Burned with Fire." You can also read it in his cover story of the August issue of The Trumpet, "Police Under Attack." Read them both on thetrumpet.com.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Since the economic recession in the United States began in 2007, the number of Americans aged 18 to 34 has grown by about 3 million. But the Census Bureau now says that in spite of the fact that there's so many more of these adults, about 500,000 fewer of them are living independently. There are now more than 20 million Americans in this age range, 18 to 34 years old, who live with their parents or other relatives. That's one in three people in this demographic. I have trumpet writer Robert Morley in the studio here with me. He's been looking at the numbers and studying this trend. Robert, first of all, you're looking at this from an economic standpoint, and this data really undermines this idea that America is in an economic recovery. That's the kind of the argument that you're making here.
Yeah, absolutely it does. If you look at the latest numbers that came out in July, the gross domestic product number that they put out said that it grew about 2.3% during the second quarter of the year. Now, that's a weak number, but at least it's positive. It's in the plus. We're advancing. The economy is getting bigger. We should be creating a lot more jobs at that rate. But here's the part of it that's probably the most worrisome. At the same time that they announced that that number was positive, they also announced that they changed the way they're calculating the GDP. And this is something that they've done a number of times over recent years. And so they said that we were going to go back, we're going to look at the numbers, and we'll get a more accurate reading on what the economy is doing. And it's very interesting what they found. And what they said is they, after looking at the numbers again, plugging it into their new formula, they found that things were actually a lot better than they realized. The exact opposite of what those stats that you talked about at the top would indicate we have millions of more young adults living at home with their families, with their parents. So these are 18 to, like you said, 18 to 34 year olds, people that would normally be out on their own. They'd be buying houses. They'd be renting apartments. But no, they're stuck living back at home with their parents. Analysts talk about them as the boomerang generation. We have these millions of people, they're back at home. So why is this happening? Why are they back at home with their folks if the economy is doing so well? So the Commerce Department looked at those numbers and they said that, for example, last year when a reading came in at -2%, they went back, plugged the numbers again in this new formula, and they found out, oh, lo and behold, the economy is growing at 0.6%. So, you know, this should be wonderful news, but it's not matching up with the reality, at least for these young people, these 3.5 million more young people that are back at home with their folks than were in 2007 before the recession began.
Okay, I'd like to just maybe separate out a couple of issues here. One is, it does seem pretty clear that there's something akin to great inflation going on here, in that every time the economists go back and look at the numbers and they say, hey, actually, we're doing really well. It looked like it was bad, but when we, you know, run these new numbers into this new formula, we're actually doing okay. And that's always the trend. Like, you almost wish that you could take today's economy and evaluate it according to the way that it was calculated maybe 40 years ago and see, well, just how well are we doing relative to the way that we were. If the measure changes, then we're not necessarily getting a real clear picture of how it is relative to the way it was.
Right, the yardstick is changing. And it is interesting that every time that they put a new calculation out there, it always shows that we're doing better than we thought. The economy is bigger than we thought. Kind of reminds me of, I think it was over in the UK, they announced last year that they had changed the way they were calculating their GDP, and they decided they were going to start including the black market in their calculations. Wow. They're going to make estimations on, you know, how many prostitutes are working in the country, how much illegal drug use is going on, and building that into the calculations. And it's what they're doing here in the US is not that far. It's not that extreme, but it seems to be within that same sort of trend, this idea that every time we recalculate it, we're doing better than we thought, or it's bigger than we thought.
Well, it is in the politicians' best interest to make it look like under their rule, things are going great.
Sure, absolutely it is.
But now, I feel like maybe you're passing the buck in a sense. You're talking about the fact that these young people are staying at home and saying, well, that must mean that the economy isn't as good as advertised. Where it seems like, let's just talk about the responsibility of these young people a little bit, because it seems to me like if a young person is motivated, and I'm saying young, I mean, we're talking about people who could be in their 30s.
Right.
That's not necessarily that young. In the past, you know, it was much more common for people in their 20s, in their early 20s, even in their late teens, to begin assuming the responsibilities of adulthood and, you know, getting married and providing for families and having children and basically going through those benchmarks of adulthood and maturity much earlier in life. And it seems like if a person is motivated to do that, they can still do that. But what we have, it seems to me, and you address this in your analysis of this situation, that they're just not as motivated. They're not interested in pursuing the life of an adult, and they're comfortable with just being a kid, remaining a kid for far longer than they have in the past.
Yeah, that's just society today, isn't it? Some of those numbers that you mentioned that I brought out in that article that's up on the website right now. There's a recent survey done by Think Money in the UK, and it found that a sixth of the British adults that still lived at home, so a sixth of these ones that were at home, they admitted that they like living at home because of the cushy existence that their parents provided. And kind of the opposite side, when they surveyed the parents, 84% of the parents that had these adult children back at home with them, these boomerang children, said that they still do laundry for them. They're still doing a lot of those basic tasks that traditionally, when you leave home, you're doing on your own. As you become an adult, you're living at home. So yeah, there is, like you said, this trend of society of adults becoming infantilized, or they're not making that leap from living at home with your parents to out on your own and assuming the full responsibilities of adulthood.
It seems very much related to the increasing dependence on the government and the willingness to milk the government for whatever benefits that you can, rather than standing on your own two feet, being self-sufficient, providing for your own, and taking a certain amount of pride in that independence and that self-sufficiency. More and more, it seems like this kind of, you know, take what you can get, don't make life any harder for yourself than you need to. We're really losing something by doing that. It seems to me like the more that we're willing to just kind of receive whatever benefits might be coming our way, the less character we build, the weaker we are, the more incapable we are of providing for ourselves. There's a broader trend that we're talking about here. In your article, you call it the wimpification of society. That seems like a center of the target, dead on assessment.
Well, I think there was something that was very unique in the United States history, especially if you were to contrast it with European history or history of other continents. When you think of the United States when it was first settled, and to think of the masculinity that was required to settle a continent, to go out into the wilds, to be dependent not on Big Brother, not dependent on the government, but dependent on your two hands, your family, and God. You had to rely on God. You had to rely on, after that, what you could do with your two hands and your family that was around you to survive. And I think for many generations, we've been living and experiencing the legacy of that. But, you know, with time, as we've progressed from more of a independent, even capitalistic type society towards of a more socialist, interdependence, more reliant on services that government provides on you, I think we're starting to lose some of those things. And the other aspect is we're becoming much more of a godless society. I don't think anybody can argue with that either.
Yeah, the authority in your life basically shifts from being God, where you're accountable to God and you're responsible for managing those resources that he gives to you and doing the best that you can and making the very most of those, taking care of those things that he provides, to the government, to a man-made system, and to just kind of just being more of a ward of the state. It seems like that it's happening on a micro scale within those families where you have these young people who aren't making that step out into adulthood.
I think you're absolutely right on that. And even recently, when we're looking at the campaigning that's going on now, we're into an election cycle. Just this morning, I saw a headline talking about Hillary Clinton's new plan for the government to pay for everybody's college tuition. And she's not alone. Bernie Sanders has his plan. Some Republicans have their plan. But it too, it seems like another step in that direction where government's going to provide everything. And sure, go ahead, go through college. We'll take care of you. We'll be your mom and dad. You don't need to get out there and become an adult and start providing for yourself, start providing for your own.
Yeah, even the college experience seems like it prolongs that.
Yeah, it's doing the opposite childhood of what it should be doing, right? Yeah. When you go to college, as you're increasing your education, it's to give you the skills so that when you're done, that you can stand as a well-rounded, well-developed individual that is ready to go out and start a family and not be reliant on, I guess, your parents or reliant on others to take care of you.
Another aspect of this, I feel like we have to hit on. I think that this really illuminates. You look at the numbers of young people who just say, look, I'm happy to just stay with mom and dad rather than starting a family, rather than getting married, providing for a family, having children who are accountable to me, you know, that I'm accountable to, that I need to provide for. Just the suppression of interest, the diminishment of interest in entering into that relationship, which I think that tells you a lot about just the decline in the sanctity of the family and the enthusiasm for family that would have been very present in a lot of young people I mean, generally speaking, people wanted to get married and they wanted to start a family and that type of thing. You just don't see that interest in the family relationship the way that, that you did in previous generations. But it, it really strikes me how much the traditional family unit is an inducement to mature. It's something that prods you to maturity, and it helps you to take those steps that create that self-sufficiency and that help you to just grow as a person. You know, if a young man says, look, I want to be able to provide for a family, then he's going to be far more motivated to get a good job, a solid job, a good paying job, to prepare himself, to educate himself for that responsibility, so that he can be in the position of a provider. Once a kid kind of has it in his mind, and you see this in a lot more young men today, they're like, well, I expect if I'm going to get married, she's going to be working. She might even have a better paying job than me. He doesn't have nearly as much incentive to try to push himself to be the best person that he can be, to accomplish and succeed as much as he is able to. Then this responsibility is shifted. It's easy for him to push that off onto the horizon. It's easier for him to justify sitting and playing video games or whatever he feels like doing. There's much more emphasis on just pleasing the self rather than being a responsible person that others can rely on.
And the irony is, so many of these people don't know what they're missing out on, because family is one of the most awesome things you can experience in life. This is something that I've talked about with my wife many times, and we wish we had started our family earlier than we had, because now as we're getting older and we're with our last son that was born, we notice how much more quickly we tired out with him than we did the first two, and we wish we could have more of it, but we're counting the costs now. But it is, like you said, I think so many of these young people, we have these generational, these cycles now of so many people growing up, and they don't know what family's about. They don't have good examples, good role models. And now they're in this position where all they know is to focus on self, gratifying self, the short-termism, letting mom do laundry for me, letting dad cook breakfast for me, whatever it is. Life's easier living at home. And they're missing these amazing opportunities, not only for them to grow and to develop their horizons, but to, you know, mold and shape little lives, the next generation.
I couldn't agree with you more, Robert. I think that's such a crucial point. The fact that you don't really know the joys that are inherent within this beautiful institution of family until you're in the thick of it, you know, and there are challenges and there are trials. And I mean, it's not easy necessarily to have the job to support the family, to do all of the ins and outs and trying to educate your children and work with them and that type of thing. But what a pleasure. I mean, when you, especially you can step back and you can see how even the trials are a joy, you know, when you look at the big picture. It is just an extraordinary institution that that just gives us a great deal of pleasure as we live it. So thank you, Robert. The title of the article that he has written, it's online at thetrumpet.com, Why Are Increasing Numbers of Adults Living with Parents? Look for it on thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
In a remote area in the nation of Israel in the Middle East, archaeologists recently uncovered a fortification that brings an era of history to life that really is of interest to any student of the Bible. I have here Brent Nachtigall, a man who's worked as an area supervisor in some exciting archaeological digs in Jerusalem. And he's going to tell us the details of this latest discovery and what it tells us. Brent, what exactly did they discover and where is it?
They were digging in this ancient town of Gath. And Gath is a territory right on the border of ancient Israel in the Philistine territories. And as they were excavating there, they've been going on digging for a number of years. But it was only in this excavation this past summer, just a couple of weeks ago, that they found the fortification line, the massive city wall that encompassed this city of Gath. And they struck gold, you might say, in archaeological terms. As they were finding this fortification line, they also found a massive gatehouse complex, really, that connects to the city wall. Now, this is huge for biblical archaeologists. This is huge for people that are interested in the Bible as well, because it really does testify to the size and scope of the Philistine nation at that time as well. Now, we all know the Philistines from the Bible. They are one of the arch nemesis of the nation of Israel from the time of Samuel, King Saul, Samson, the massive strength of Samson, everybody remembers him. And all the way up to the time of King David, the Philistines were a huge people and a prominent people and virtually on par with the size of Israel. And here they are digging, you know, in 2015, and they're only now resurrecting this huge city wall and gatehouse of those people.
So this gives us a sense of just how prominent these people were in a way that nothing that we've uncovered, archaeologically speaking, has given us to this point.
Well, we knew that the extent of their territory was quite vast from other archaeological digs. People have been digging on this Philistine coast or the area of Gaza Strip right now and a little bit further north and to the east. Philistine territory went all the way up till north of Tel Aviv, and it went all the way inland till this township of Gath, which is probably another 15 kilometers or 10 miles out from where the Gaza Strip is right now. So it's a much bigger area than we think of the Gaza Strip. So there have been excavations in the past that have found the Philistine culture in these areas, but not until now have they been able to put a value, I guess, on the size of their military might, on the size of how many people this city could hold. This is one of the chief cities of the Philistines. The Bible says that, this is the town of Gath. And finding this city wall gives an indication of how big the city was. And then finding how big this gatehouse is as well. And you can compare that to other gatehouses throughout Israel. And if they're comparable or if they're on the same size or even perhaps some larger than the ones in Israel at that time, it gives a good indication of how big that people were and how mighty that people were as well.
So where is this mentioned? Is the gate itself actually mentioned in the Bible?
The gate is mentioned in the Bible. It is an awesome correlation of scripture and artifact when we have something like this. It's in 1 Samuel 21 and verse 13. I was just going to read that scripture because it is a kind of an epic scene. This is the time when King David is running from King Saul. David isn't king yet, but he's on the run and he has to escape from Saul's men. Saul's trying to put him to death. So he escapes to this town of Gath to try and seek some safety. And when he arrives there, they pick him out, and some of the people say to the king, King Achish that was there, isn't this David that killed our man Goliath a few years earlier? And at that time, I'll just read what he does, because I think it's familiar to some people, but others might not recollect this somewhat comical exchange. It says here in verse 12, this is 1 Samuel 21, verse 12, and David laid up these words in his heart and was sore afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So somebody picked him out saying, that's King David. And David was scared of what this king of the Philistines of the town of Gath would do. And verse 13, it says, and he changed his behavior before them, that is David, and he feigned himself mad in their hands, and he scribbled on the doors of the gate and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. So he totally saw that his cover was blown and he had to try and make himself out as mad. So he lets saliva dribble down his beard. He goes a little crazy and then he scribbles something, whether it's with his hand or an instrument, we're not sure, but on the door of the gate. So this is... Well, how we know it's not another door of another gate? Well, ancient cities, they only had maybe one or two gates. They didn't want to have many gates because then the gates are the most vulnerable part of the city. They needed a high wall and a strong gate. And kings, they are normally present at the gate a lot of the time because that's where official business is done. That's where commerce takes place. You have people entering. You want to know who these foreigners are entering your town. So the king will often be there. So it makes sense that David is here at this city gate. And that's when he's spotted, as you would be by the Philistine soldiers. And that's when he has this incident where he goes mad and starts scribbling on one of the doors here of the gate. So that's one of the humorous elements of this, of where this city is mentioned in the Bible.
I'm assuming there isn't any ancient scribbling. There's no Davidic graffiti on this gate.
There could be at some point found that. The problem with excavations is they take a long time. Now, this gatehouse has only been discovered this year in a six-week season, so they didn't have much time to dig it. They're probably down maybe 2 feet, 3 feet, so there's plenty of digging to go down. What they've probably found, they have been kind of tight-lipped about it, but they've probably just found the foundational level of this or whatever would remain, so you probably wouldn't find wooden elements that would remain.
Sure.
But there's plenty more excavation seasons. They determined that it probably take another five or six seasons even to get to the bottom of, or to get to bedrock to see where this gate is actually founded upon. So they've only actually just discovered the top of it as of now.
So that biblical passage that you just read, the evidence that they would use to say this is the gate, you mentioned certainly the location is right. The fact that a city like that would have only had one, maybe two gates. What other evidence would they use to confirm, yes, we're talking about this particular biblically mentioned gate or gatehouse?
Right. Well, here's the problem with archaeology. Unless you find an inscription or David's graffiti on saying he was there, or he probably would have mentioned his name in that case, but unless you find something like that, you can never be 100% sure. But you can put a lot of these logical deductions together to present a powerful case. One other thing that you would have to match up to prove that this was the gate that David was at would be the dating of the date as well, because you can find a gate anywhere in Israel and say it's from King David. Well, does it match up with, was it built during that time? What did it exist at that time? And this gatehouse is part of the Iron Age fortifications, early Iron Age, Iron II, and that's when David did rule. We know that. That's been established in other sites. So this gatehouse matches the time of King David as well.
Can you give us just a Reader's Digest version of how you would date something like this? What specific techniques that you would use to find the dating?
Well, dating in the Middle East rests on a number of elements that you can use to date things. The first would be carbon dating. If you find, for example, if you were digging next to a wall and you found dirt or a floor that was built touching that wall, then that wall had to have been there when that floor was built. And if you're going to dig underneath the foundation of that floor and you find a carbon sample, an olive pit, anything organic, then you can take that away and you'll know the latest possible time that that wall was built because of the floors that's attaching to it. Now, carbon dating is more of a recent tool that archaeologists use. They mainly use pottery to date things. Pottery is a phenomenal tool in the hands of archaeologists because it changes so rapidly over time. Every 25 to 50 years, you have a change in pottery, just as you would have a change in the model of a car over time. So if an archaeologist has the huge gamut.
You're not saying that the pottery itself changes, but that the style.
Styles, or, right, yeah. The style of the pottery, the shape of the rims, what it's made of, whether it's got like a shiny surface on it. All these things change over time. Maybe not every one of those elements, but transitionally, they all change over time. So an archaeologist's job is he's in the business of knowing about the age of all material stuff. And pottery is used mainly because it's everywhere. People use plates just like we use plates. It breaks down. It often gets broken. And then people are too lazy sometimes to pick it up because it's not worth anything. There's so much of it. It's everywhere throughout Israel. So that's the tool that they use mainly for dating. And they've looked at the pottery that is adjacent and on top of this gate as well, so they can get the latest possible date that this gatehouse was in use. And they've determined that was somewhere around the mid-8th century, around King Uzziah, a bit thereafter. And so you know when it was latest in use. Right now they don't know when it was constructed because they haven't excavated all the way down at the bottom of the gate. But from just the huge size of the gate, from the huge stones that were used in its creation, if they're going to match those things up with comparable gates that have been fully excavated in Israel, then they can get a pretty good idea of when it was used.
The Trumpet has drawn attention to several recent discoveries that corroborate the biblical record. How would you rate this in, say, among those other discoveries, or where would you, what does this mean in terms of biblical archaeology?
I think that for many people, this will not be a news flash in you know, any sense of the phrase. It's something that was expected. Even this archaeologist that was digging there, he was had a good estimated guess of where this could be found, and he started digging one of his areas there. You don't have time to dig a whole hill. You can only pick certain spots. So he knew that it was probably going to be there. Now, I think it's important mainly because of the debate that is centered around the existence of King David and King Solomon and whether these biblical leaders ruled in the way that the Bible describes them, whether they had power over the territory that the Bible describes that they had. And I think this gate is a pretty good help to support that case. We all know that. Who was King David fighting? He fought Goliath under the reign of King Saul. Then it was only under King David's rule that the Philistines were actually defeated. So the Bible paints the Philistines as a mighty people. Now, if David is going to defeat these Philistines, that with the Philistines we know were a mighty people, that David is going to have to be a mighty leader as well. So in a roundabout way, it does help show that the Israelite nation was on par before David with the Philistines. And then when David came along, and definitely in Solomon's reign, they actually overcome that Philistine adversary, which was sizable, testified by this gate.
That's something that Bible critics have really tried to undermine, the claims of the Bible as to the scope of the power that Israel had at that time.
Certainly, especially relating to King David. He's one of the most central figures in the Bible, upon a lot of promises hinge. And there has been this push ever since the 70s, 80s, into even the early 90s to try and do away with that awesome history of King David, saying that he didn't rule like the Bible said. But lately, ever since 1994, I think it was, there was an artifact that was found that had David's name on it. It said the House of David, that proved that he existed. Because up until the early 90s, some people were saying David didn't even exist. There's no proof of him. But they found his name indicating that he had a dynasty that was in the north of Israel. And then there has been artifacts and discoveries, even in Jerusalem, King David's palace as well, that further testifies to his existence. And the magnitude of that palace again shows that he was a mighty ruler. And now we have other evidence, even coming from the cultures that he defeated, to show that that's the case.
Fascinating stuff, Brent. Thank you. The article Brent Noctegal has written is called Massive Fortifications Discovered at Goliath's Hometown. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Brent.
No problem. It's good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It is time for Q&A. David Vigil, our social media manager, is here with me in the studio. How are you doing, David?
Doing great.
So David has his fingers on the pulse of our listeners, taking the requests from online, email, from the website, anywhere that people send questions into us, and he fires them at me. David, you have a question for us.
Yes, I have two questions. This first one comes from the Trumpet website in response to the article Chaos Reigns in St. Paul Schools,
We've talked about this quite a bit on this program as well.
That's true, yes. And written by Robert Morley, he said the question's from Logan Chancellor. And Logan says, I invite you, Mr. Morley, to please explain how you know Michael Brown and Eric Garner would be alive today had they complied with officers' requests.
Okay, I'm not Robert Morley, but I will take a stab at this. And you know, this obviously we can't know for absolute certain, but knowing these high-profile cases where the facts that we do know about Michael Brown, Eric Garner, in both of those cases, there was resistance to the police that preceded the tragedy of the death of both of those men. It was because of a scuffle. It was because, you know, leave me alone, or why are you bothering me, or that type of thing. The point that Robert has made in his article was that the law-abiding citizen who, when an authority says, you know, get off of the street, or you know, why are you selling these illegal cigarettes? And I'm not defending what those police did, but if the individual in that case had done what was requested of them, it wouldn't have escalated to the point where it ended up causing the loss of life. The point that he made in that article, not defending what the police did, I don't think you have to get into the details to that degree, but if someone did comply with the initial request to, you know, to go along with what the officer was asking, it wouldn't have escalated.
Okay. There you go, Logan. There's your answer.
You said you have a second question.
I do. And this one is from Facebook. Now, this is more of a general question here, and it's from Ryan Downs. And he asks, what are your thoughts on Dr. Ben Carson, Donald Trump, both of whom are running for president?
Our thoughts on presidential candidates?
Yes, sir.
And these two in particular. I think Ben Carson is a good guy. From everything that I know about him, I don't know a whole lot about him. I actually have one of his books that I haven't read yet. But he seems like a very admirable man in a lot of ways. Donald Trump, he's an interesting man. When it comes to presidential politics, to be honest with you, the way that this is playing out, we really do have a different view of presidential politics than the average person does. Basically because the idea that, well, you could really take this several different ways, but I feel like the basic dilemma is that the system, and I think a lot of Americans would agree with this as they're watching this, the presidential politics begin to play out as we look forward to the next presidential election, that the what it takes to rise to the top, in the last several elections, what we have seen is the inability of the candidates who really do reflect strong character, principled positions, and the possibility of really making a positive difference on the country, getting lost in the shuffle or failing to get over the top and be able to take office. And there are a number of reasons for that, and you could go on and on about why that is. But when I'm looking at the current crop of presidential candidates on the Republican side, it seems like the deck is so strongly stacked against those who could possibly make a difference, and that it's the chances of someone ending up in power who is a compromise candidate and who isn't going to really help the country are so high that there is a lot of reason for a lot of pessimism. And it seems like a lot of Americans are kind of getting into this mindset of it's difficult to be optimistic when you see time after time the process result in failure. I was reading recently, someone was talking about the fact that the last two congressional elections produced massive Republican majorities, but it was careerist politicians who won, and they came into power, and despite having a tremendous majority within Congress, they have done nothing to prevent some of the most destructive policies from being enacted, and they've only sent four bills to President Obama that he vetoed, because essentially they're not creating law that he's opposed to. They're so careful to operate within the system and to be, you know, compromising and to think in terms of consensus and all of that, that they're not challenging this president as he's taking very dangerous positions that are destructive to the country. So that it's for that reason that, among several others, that I think people are quite pessimistic about the system in general and its ability to produce outcomes that really will benefit the country.
All right. Well, there you go, Ryan. No matter who it is, Carson or Trump, it's probably not going to benefit the country.
That's a kind of a fatalistic view. But, you know, we do explain it more. We have articles on thetrumpet.com that try to give more of the overview of what it is about the political system that we view as kind of the fundamental flaws with it, and why, what does God think about our political process? That's a question that not a lot of people tend to ask, but it is very worth studying into, and it's one that it's really a matter of where do you place your trust. And there is a place to place your trust that yields far better results.
Yes, and we could probably link to some of those articles in the show notes. So if anyone's interested in reading further, they can find those articles.
That's why we bring you in here, David. You know how to handle that. All right, well, thanks for coming in. That'll do it for Q&A today. Talk to you later.
See ya.
It's time for today's last word.
Do you care too much about what other people think of you? We all want to be liked, and that's not necessarily bad. It can motivate us to eliminate annoying habits and to treat other people well, but it can easily become a problem. We all risk putting too much value on others' opinions, especially negative opinions. And with social media, this tendency has gotten a mega rocket boost. People obsess over managing their online reputations, the number of followers and friends and favorites and likes and so on. And online, people tend to spout off mean, nasty comments pretty freely. Absorbing yourself in that noisy, ugly world can give you terrible insecurity. It can distort your decision-making, destroy your confidence, even your faith. If you've ever fallen into these traps, here's some great advice from a very wise man who understood a lot about human nature long before any of us picked up a smartphone. King Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 21, "Take no heed unto all words that are spoken, lest you hear your servant curse you." Okay, so you don't have any servants, but think about Solomon's point. He's addressing your attitude toward what others say about you, and particularly criticism. Don't go asking around for what people are saying, he advises. Don't be over-anxious about their evil reports. Don't be curious to hear how they judge you, whether in person or online. Here's the thing. When you go fishing for comments, you're looking for praise. You want to hear good things, things that, frankly, just appeal to your vanity. So even if you get what you want and you do hear praise, it's not necessarily good for you. But as this verse says, that probably isn't what you'll hear. If you're snooping around trying to learn what people really think of you, you're going to hear something bad. And that's an excellent reason not to snoop. This verse says there are things that you're actually better off not even hearing. When you overhear that cutting comment, what can you do about it anyway? It's only going to frustrate you and upset you. Like it or not, people will curse you. That's life. So what? Solomon says, take no heed. Even when you do happen to hear a nasty remark, the verse says, do not take to heart everything people say. In other words, act like you didn't even hear it. Now, obviously, you need to hear constructive criticism. We all need correction. We need to be correctable. We need to be willing to make changes that make us better people. Solomon isn't saying to be deaf toward that. He's saying ignore snippety, gossipy chatter. And in our hyper-connected world, there's a lot of that flying around, and it's easy to take offense at the slightest thing and turn pinpricks into civil wars. The next verse, Ecclesiastes 7, verse 22, gives more wisdom that puts other people's comments in perspective. It says, "Your heart knows that many times you have yourself cursed others." Admit it. You've said bad things about others, things you hope they don't hear. You shouldn't have, but you have, and so have I. When you hear someone saying something bad about you, instead of getting upset, take it as an opportunity to reflect on your own mistakes in that area. Check your emotions, then think about how you've criticized others, and then strengthen your resolve to avoid backbiting and gossip and to protect other people's reputations. In Titus 3, the Apostle Paul wrote, "Speak evil of no man, for we ourselves also were sometimes foolish. We all make mistakes. It's easy to judge others, but there are plenty of things about you that could be condemned just as easily. Remember that, and you'll have more patience for the guy who says something unflattering about you. Most all of us need to be less concerned about what other people think and more concerned about what God thinks. Paul wrote in Galatians 1, "Am I now seeking the approval of man or of God, or am I just trying to please man?" He said, "If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Follow Solomon's excellent advice. It's sure to spare you a lot of nonsense and heartache. When it comes to negative comments, don't listen to the haters. Listen to Solomon. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Read the stories there that we talked about on the program today. We'll even give you a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. No charge. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus by searching The Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley and Brent Nocton. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Henry Adams. A teacher affects eternity. You can never tell where his influence stops. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG. And on the web at kpcg.fm.